Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The 1995 novel Canicula by folklorist, author, and educator Norma Elia Cantú is a self-described autobioethnography. To put it in simpler terms, it's a fictionalized memoir that tells the story of Azucena Nena Cantú, a girl that grew up on the South Texas-Mexico border in the 1950s and 60s. Cantú says it's not autobiography and it's not memoir. The book deviates from the character Nena to draw observations of her surroundings and her culture, and it contains Norma Cantú's personal photos. The long-awaited follow-up is the novel Cabañuelas, published in 2019. It's 1980, and Nena is now an adult, leaving for Europe for the first time to study fiestas in Spain and how they're still practiced with a more local flair in South Texas communities that were conquered land centuries ago. Nena travels the country for her research and falls in love with a proud Spaniard named Paco. Cantú says it took many years for Cabañuelas to see the light of day.
Originally, the book had two components. It was in Laredo in 2000. I thought that was significant, new century, all of that. And Spain in 1980, also significant because it's post-Franco. And actually, I had a Fulbright to do research in 1980 and in 1985. And it just seemed a good kind of complement to have the two, the Spanish and the Texan realities. However, when I finished it and turned it in, the readers for the publisher did not agree with me and said, these are two books, and suggested that I separate the Laredo, Texas experience and the Spain experience. I resisted it. I did not want to break my book apart. I thought it was what it was. And so I put it away for years. How many? Almost 20 years.
Wow.
95, 96. I think I finished it in 2000. So, yeah, 16 years later. And this one kept nagging at me, just there in the back of my mind. And finally, I said, okay, let me look at it. I went back, read the whole thing, and thought, you know, maybe there is something to this idea of putting it apart. I pulled apart the areas, the stories that had to do with Spain and the stories that had to do with Laredo. I chose to go with the ones in Spain to educate, maybe to show that our culture has roots in Spain as well as indigenous. Many of the traditions are blends, like the matachines. You can see some of the dance steps and the music in Spain, as well as, of course, the indigenous drumming and some other traditions in matachines. So I thought, okay, I'm going to just focus on Nena's experiences on the Fulbright in Spain. And she goes to all these fiestas. I have all these photographs. So then the book kind of took shape that way.
So do you think that maybe people who are entering this book, not realizing they're reading your story, once they start seeing these real photos that she took there, they finally start sort of putting the pieces together?
Well, and that's the other kind of conundrum, because the photos are, both in Canicula and Cabañuelas, are designed to confuse, if you will. So you think, okay, this is fiction. Oh, but there's a photograph. How is that? And I use the images for two purposes. One, to kind of ground the story in a visual, in an image. And it adds to the narrative in that way. You can also read the image apart from reading the prose. And then the second purpose is to kind of confuse that reality fiction kind of ambiguity. An ambiguity that is born out of the experience of living. Because actually, if you start remembering, you're probably going to make up some stuff.
Though you're not realizing you're making it up.
Of course, you think it's your story. And yet, the studies that have shown how memory functions tell us that it is very unreliable because we see things that we want to see or things that we know. And we couch our experiences within those frames of things that we've already experienced that shapes how we see the world or things that we want to see. We make it up, basically. So a friend asked me, how do you remember all those details? And I said, well, I remember a lot because I have a very good memory, but I also make it up. I don't remember what color dress I was wearing. I'll make it up. On the other hand, I think when Nana and Paco are in Paris, she's wearing some shirt that has some glittery threads through it. And it's a very specific detail. And I remember that blouse. I had that blouse. I wore that blouse. So it's a combination, I would think. Yeah.
Well, you brought up Paco, and there was a really great review that I read of your book that describes it as a love story blended with cultural anthropology. And so tell us a little bit about this character, Paco, and let us know if there was a real Paco in Norma Cantu's life in Spain in 1980.
That's the big question. I have to admit that, yes, there was a person, not named Paco, but yes, there was a person that I was in love with. That was in 1980. The autobiography part of it allows for the cultural anthropology. So the person had many characteristics as Paco. Loved opera, went to play soccer Sunday mornings. But of course, I make up some parts of it. And I think that the process of creating a fiction, well, I'm not even going to say just fiction, anything. It's a synthesis. You bring in and you call from the experiences to create this other experience that sometimes it's strictly by the book exactly what happened, but often it's not.
So your character kind of struggles a little bit with the South Texas conquest of Spain and your research of Spain. You constantly bring, even though you said earlier you had to separate your Laredo stories from the Spanish stories, you still bring Laredo into the story because you bring it with you. That character of Laredo is staying with you, and you struggle a little bit with, well, here I am trying to learn about this culture that essentially has stifled the indigenous culture of South Texas. And here is your character, Nena, dating Paco, who is very proudly Spanish, proud of his culture, sometimes looks down on Nena's own beliefs, including some of the Catholicism that she still carries with her. So how much of that resonated with your actual experience? And why did you decide to sort of bring that internal struggle out?
I think it's a very real struggle for all of us who are mestizos, mestizas in the Americas, that the relationship con la madre patria, as it were, has always been tenuous and difficult. I remember even earlier, the first time I went to Spain, they are very racist. some of them at that point were ignorant of the world. I mean, they had been under Franco for 40 years, and the schools, the education they received, everything was jaded by that dictatorship. So, of course, they're going to have a different view of the world. So, for me, I needed to bring that in because Nena's conflict is based on that lifelong view of the Spanish. I had a grandmother who claimed to be Española, and my dad's mother. But I always saw that part of my family as looking down on my mom's part of the family that were more indigenous. And so it's a very personal conflict about which part do you identify with, which part do you honor? Well, both, because you are both. And Anzaldúa, Gloria Anzaldúa, the Chicana philosopher, talks about that. We have to recognize all of the parts that we are and honor them. We are who we are as mestizas, mestizos, because of that, what do I want to call it, cultural and genetic mixing. Our traditions have elements of Arabic, Asian, and, of course, the European and the indigenous. So we are a mixture of all of these. And So I wanted to include that because one thing that happens when you're a writer, you're working things out for yourself. You're kind of putting it out there. It's not easy. It's sometimes scary. But I always believe that you need to go where the scary part is to confront those demons, if you will. And for me, it was my grandmother, my dad's mother, who was Española and held on to that elitist view of the world and sometimes racist, looking down on the indigenous. So I wanted to grapple with that. And I think Nena does a good job of that. She kind of confronts Paco, but she also acknowledges that there are some good things. Like he criticizes her saying, mande. Well, in South Texas, that's what we say. Why? The indigenous people were subservient. They were in abject positions where they were being mandados by the elites, the owners of the land, or the Spanish who claimed ownership of the land. So you have that resistance. But she recognizes that, yeah, he's right. I shouldn't be saying mande.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, mande is sort of similar to tell me what to do.
Right. Order me.
Order me.
For me, it's an unconscious response when somebody tells you something and you don't hear what they're saying. It's like, excuse me or pardon. It's the equivalent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But just like the other response, a sus órdenes.
A sus órdenes, mm-hmm. Yeah, at your orders. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those kind of automatic, inherently charged in terms of class and race and all of that, linguistic expressions, I think tell a lot about a culture. And so that's why they're in there también.
We're talking with Norma Cantú, folklorist, author, and daughter of the borderlands. She's the author of Cabañuelas, an autobioethnography that could also be described as fictionalized memoir. When we come back, Cantú talks about her new collection of poetry.
So there's poems about love, and there's poems about life on the border, and poems about labor workers.
More with Norma Cantú next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Norma Elia Cantú is a folklorist, writer, and Murchison Professor of Humanities at Trinity University. This year, she's published a couple of works, the novel Cabañuelas and the collection of poetry, Meditación Fronteriza, Poems of Love, Life, and Labor. Cantú says it's her first ever collection of poetry. And a heads up, this part of the interview takes a hard left turn into George Washington's birthday.
I would say it's a recopilation of about 30 years, maybe even longer. Because I know one poem was when I was in Spain in 1980. So it goes back that long. I have many, many poems, and I had to cull through all of that to find the ones that fit into this book. And I structured it around those three areas. So there's poems about love, and there's poems about life on the border, and poems about labor workers. And there's several others that have to do with just working life of labor. It's an interesting word because it could be labor like work, but it could also be like just labor birthing. I really think that when you write your birthing books, if you will, poems, characters, you're living life, giving life to other ideas. The collection, Meditación Fronteriza, has a title poem, Meditación Fronteriza, that concludes the entire collection. And if you notice, it's written, I believe, three different times with the same title. But it really chronicles the way the border has changed.
And to me, it's also visually different because it almost looks narrative rather than...
They're prose poems.
Exactly.
Yes.
Poems you would normally see as, you know, short stanzas or indentations in between the lines, but this one looks almost more narrative, like you were saying. It's a prose poetry.
Right.
So can you explain a little bit the changes that you've seen on the border that you've expressed in those three parts?
Sure. Some of the poems harken back to my childhood when the border was pretty open and we went and came and it was fine. There's, I think, one poem that talks about traditions, of course, always the folklore part. And those are mostly about the fiestas, I mean, George Washington's birthday, of course, being from Laredo.
Big Laredo. That's right, George Washington, Laredo native. Yes. Explain that, too, because some people might not know that tradition.
Well, it started 1890s, and it was a group of white people from San Antonio who bring the Improved Order of Red Men chapter to Laredo. There's a group in Laredo who wants this to happen. This is the 1890s, a few years, not even 50 years after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo makes Laredo part of the United States. Unlike other border cities, Laredo has the downtown and all of the center of life on the northern part of the river, on the northern banks, whereas many others, Matamoros, El Paso, it's with Ciudad Juarez, they're on the southern mm-hmm. part of the river, on the southern banks. So here in Laredo, the history is a little different than other places. And when it becomes part of the U.S., it doesn't. Culturally, it remains part of Mexico. It remains Mexican. I think even into the 1920s, the city records and such were in Spanish. So that tells you who was governing and what was happening. Well, this Improved Order of Red Men established a chapter in Laredo, and their claim to fame is George Washington. He was a charter member. It was a fraternal organization started on the East Coast by people like Hamilton and Washington and them. And it was a very strange thing. You were inducted into the society. It was a secret kind of thing by nomination. You went up the ranks until you became the Grand Sachem, and that would be like the chief. It's an indigenous structure. So at the same time,
that's really confusing.
Well, especially because it's at the same time that they're decimating the indigenous population, they established this honorary kind of club, if you will, that celebrates indigeneity. It's crazy. So it comes to Laredo, and of course it doesn't stay Anglo very long because a lot of the elites are Mexicanos, and they also become part of it. The big celebration is George Washington's birthday. And so I believe the first one was 1895 in Laredo. They have a celebration. They dress up like 18th century George Washington people. They begin a...
You would do on the border.
Of course, with the white wigs and the whole thing. And you have a presentation ball, and the young women, the daughters of the elites. First, the Society for Martha Washington is established. That's the women's part of it, like an auxiliary. And they select the daughters presented in society. So it becomes a combination of like a cotillion and a presentation in court, if you will, like in Europe. And you have these elaborate dances, performance, the whole thing. That's still going on. In 1980, they add another element, which is kind of to balance it. So it's not just the elites. The Pocahontas Council. I know.
Oh,
so the Princess Pocahontas Council also presents the young ladies who turn 18 that year to society, but they are dressed like no indigenous woman was ever dressed in these beautifully embroidered indigenous themed, I can't call them indigenous attire because it's not, but they have the beadwork and they have all these things. And it really is a spectacle. And part of it is the reenactment of the battle, and the Princess Pocahontas is given the keys to the city. It's pretty much entrenched as a ritual, as a ceremony for Laredo to affirm its U.S. identity as Americans, but always there's an insertion of the Mexicano. The other part that I find fascinating, when I was growing up, we were dressed like China Poblana to go to the parade.
Can you explain what China Poblana
is? Yeah. Well, if you've ever seen the Mexican hat dance, it's the dress that the woman wears. It's this beautifully embroidered with sequins skirt and also embroidered blouse that's just embroidered with silk. And the little girls, like myself, who were dressed like that, I mean, that's certainly Mexican. It's an affirmation of your Mexicanness. Well, to me, that's also a resistance Because, yes, we're going to celebrate George Washington, but we're Mexican, and we know it. Nowadays, it has even grown bigger. The Jalapeño Fest is involved. You have the Jalapeño Queen. You have a Jalapeño Eating Contest. You have a jazz concert. I mean, it just goes on and on almost the whole month in February.
We're listening to writer and folklorist Norma Elia Cantú. There's a lot more to this conversation about festivals, oppression, and poetry. You'll have to tune in next week for part two of our conversation. Norma Cantú is the Murchison Distinguished Professor of Humanities at Trinity University in San Antonio. Recent works include Transcendental Train Yard with Marta Sanchez and the works we touched on today, Cabañuelas, and the poetry collection Meditación Fronteriza, which we will explore more in depth next week. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.